Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, March 18th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. What a week. That means tonight we've got important events to cover in money and markets, and your questions. We've got one great question in Ask Catherine, then a very rich and juicy discussion with Jim Norman, veteran reporter, author of The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. For a movie, I'm going to touch again on Syriana, George Clooney's thriller about oil politics in the Middle East, which we watched and discussed last year. We're going to go an extra 30 minutes tonight. That's 90 minutes, because this conversation is so important. This is a very important book, a very important person, and a very, very important topic, and a topic that underlays all the current events we're watching. So we need the time. If you can stay with us, that's great. And no problem if you can't. You'll get an enormous amount just sticking with us as long as you do, and you can always pick it up tomorrow after we post the MP3 at your cart. Okay, money and markets. The news that says it all about the current state of the global economy came in a story from Bloomberg, announced today. It's up on the blog. Here it is. Central bank gold holdings expanded fastest pace since 1964. Central banks added the most gold to their reserves since 1964 last year, amid the longest rally in bullion prices in at least nine decades. Combined holdings rose 425.4 metric tons to 30,116.9 tons, an increase worth $13.3 billion at last year's average price, according to the data. India, Russia, and China last year added to the reserves. That expansion was the first since 1988, the data from London-based Council show. Central banks now hold about 18% of all the gold ever mined. So very, very interesting comment on the global economy. Dennis Gartman is quoted in the article as saying gold is quietly at the edge of becoming the world's second reservable currency. I'm shocked that I agree with Dennis Gartman, but there it is. The currency wars continued, particularly the grousing between China and the U.S. grew this week over the relative values of the two currencies. The Chinese peg theirs to the U.S., and of course that means more imports from China here, while the president is trying to promote exports to China. More on the politics of managing that relationship when we speak with Jim later on in our conversation. The theme tonight is legislative lockdown. And what that means is Washington is passing legislation designed to lock down anything in the economy that they don't yet control. The image that I want you to keep in your mind is my image of the hungry tapeworm looking for a supper and luring everyone in with something that may probably turn out to be a Trojan horse. Of course, the big question mark right now is health care. The president is using enormous amounts of political clout, essentially all he's got, to get this bill passed. And it's clear to me that somebody's telling him to do it. So the question is, he's under orders to get this done and is calling in all his cards to get it done. And you know, the big question, of course, in my mind is who's asking and why do they want it? And my concern is it has nothing to do with helping people who do not have health care, something I'd love to see happen. Rasmussen's survey says 43% are still continue to be for it, and that's not enough to get legislation of this kind. You need a stronger consensus just as a political matter. So jamming it through, either trying or accomplishing it in an election year in particular, is very dangerous. A second Rasmussen poll up this week indicates that 50% are less likely to vote for a congressional member who voted for health care. a wonderful lob across the bow. Alan Grayson, congressman from Florida, sponsored a bill based on the idea initially proposed by Howard Dean. And it's a good one. Allow everyone to buy into Medicare. And apparently now has, as of this morning, had 50 sponsors. So, you know, it's a little late to be taken seriously, I'm sure, by the political process. But it goes to show that the current bill and its failure to deal with the inflated costs of profit the drug companies and the insurance companies you know, that there is a simple alternative. A great blog post that I posted at the blog this week, a warning to Nancy Pelosi by one of the top financial members of the blogosphere, really outlines the voice of the people who are angry about the idea of being mandated to buy private insurance. There's a new wrinkle. The president is proposing that the Medicare tax to help fund this be applied to unearned income, which could be very, very painful for investors and significantly increase the cost of equity capital just at a time when we need to invest more money in equity and sort of the shenanigans and corruption in the financial system has made it that much harder to circulate equity. And it just underscores the importance to all of us of finding ways of circulating equity either on our networks or locally if we're going to create income and jobs and not allow the process to literally cut the blood off to the life of those things that create income for our team. Dennis Kucinich announced, I guess it was late last night or early this morning after a ride on Air Force One, that he was going to vote for the health care bill, and it's a very interesting part of the negotiations that's worth looking at. He was interviewed on Democracy Now! This morning. It's a, the video's up on the blog. My guess, just looking at his face, hearing his description, if I was confident I could get the truth, I would bet a very large sum of money that the people he loves, whether it's his siblings or children, he has one child, or a member of his family, were threatened with physical harm. I just think the you're looking at an example of a level of hardball that is extraordinary, and Kucinich was a very noticeable Democrat who was holding out and not part necessarily of the Blue Dog Democrats. So, you know, he didn't have air cover to say no, and he was very, very important for the president to bring into the tent. But it gives you a sense of how ugly this thing is probably getting. Idaho was the first, beating out Virginia, who's got legislation pending, to pass a law relieving its citizens from compliance with the yet-to-be-passed Health Care Act. It's called the Idaho Health Care Freedom Act. You can see the post on the blog. And it says, quote, every person within the state of Idaho is and shall be free to choose or decline to choose any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. One of the things the article suggests is that the attorney generals are looking at this and looking at the 10th Amendment issue. So I think even if this legislation passes, we're going to see a real battle in the trenches, including in the states with some attorney generals as to what the legalities and the constitutional issues are here of the federal government mandating an extraordinary expense on businesses and citizens alike to basically be required to buy services from a private corporation. Up on the blog now, the special report that I promised last week on the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act are the reports that a description and detail on the House version. Dodd has a new version that's come out in the Senate, and what we've got up is the House version, and Dodd's changed, and again, he does not have Republican support for his version. He's the Democratic leader in the Senate. So I'm sure what comes out of the spaghetti factory is going to look very different than either the House version and somewhat different than Dodd, and we're going to try and stay on top of this and cover it as the process goes by. What political capital is left on the part of the Democrats to push this through after whatever happens on health care happens? Hard to tell. Again, election year, hard to do. The primary winner of the proposed legislation, whether the House version or Dodd's version, is the U.S. government and the Fed. What that means is the people or the institutions that have been really the leader of creating the housing bubble and engineering the fraud are now given more power, and the message is clearly crime pays. It's going to exacerbate the gap between the insiders who are backed by the federal credit and those not. Very, very important story. Looks like a a little thing, but very good indication of this, is the story about Goldman Sachs demands derivatives collateral it won't dish out. It's from Bloomberg this week. It's up on the blog. Let me just read you the beginning. Goldman Sachs Group and J.P. Morgan Chase, two of the biggest traders of over-the-counter derivatives, are exploiting their growing clout in that market to secure cheap funding in addition to billions in revenue from the businesses. Both New York-based banks are demanding unequal arrangements with hedge fund firms, forcing them to post more cash collateral to offset risks on trades while putting up less on their own wagers. At the end of December, this imbalance furnished Goldman Sachs with $110 billion, according to the filing. That's money it can reinvest in higher-yielding assets. Okay, that is exactly what I described in the speech I made at Gata Goes to Washington. Let me just, and I was describing it in response to the first package of financial reforms put forward by Secretary Paulson during the bailout period. Again, it's called the Paulson Plan, again proposing significant increase in Fed powers. Here's what I said. It's an extraordinary proposal to expand the Federal Reserve's power, including consolidation of control of all U.S. payment systems enforcement powers with respect to anything that moves in the U.S. financial sector, and full authority with the President's Working Group of Financial Markets to politically and arbitrarily determine the cost of capital of every player in the economy through government-funded means. This means that the so-called cartel can ensure that any company's cost of capital, presuming we even have access to capital, is many multiples of that of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase, that is, themselves, without regard to fundamental economic productivity and performance. On top of that, they can stick the bill for this politicized state of affairs back on us, whether through taxation, inflation, or regulation. Ultimately, no real economy, no real civilization can survive such a drain. It's extraordinary. What is happening is the market believes one group of players have not just federal backing, but the ability to generate insider trading profits essentially at no risk, and therefore their cost of capital is phenomenally lower. There was a piece, Michael Lewis, author of Liar's Poker, has a new book out, was interviewed in 60 Minutes, and I took a little excerpt and put it up on the blog, and it's an example. He's describing the ability to borrow from the Fed in the short markets and lend back to the Treasury in the long markets, and literally just print money on a riskless basis, basically describing a variation of what I just read. And as I said before, no economy, basically it's only a matter of time where you go to essentially a Soviet economy in this kind of model. Now, a new act is going to make everything worse, and the problem is that we didn't get a bubble, and we didn't get a financial coup d'etat, and we didn't get fraud because we didn't enforce the laws less, or because we didn't have the laws. I'm not saying that there aren't some laws that would have been very useful not to cancel Glass-Steagall. It would be very useful to have transparency and some regulation of derivatives. But the biggest problem was not the laws. The biggest problem was we didn't enforce the laws we had. So if you're not going to enforce the laws you have, passing new laws are not going to make a whole big bunch of difference. Now, speaking of derivatives, which is an area where we need transparency and regulation, any little bit would help. GATA Chairman Bill Murphy is going to testify next week before the Commodities Future Trading Commission, the acronym is CFTC for short. They're holding open hearings to take comments on transparency and regulation in the commodities markets. And we've been following it closely on the blog. We're going to continue to. His statement, Bill's statement, just went up on the Internet tonight, so it's going to be up on the blog. One of the issues that is of extraordinary concern is the concentration in the gold and silver futures markets. In fact, a small handful of big banks have such big concentrations that they stopped publishing the positions in the short market, in the shorts, because for fear that it would disclose the individual players. It's that concentrated. We're going to be posting a special report on these issues. It should come out this weekend or next week on the blog. The banks who have the largest shorts in the market also serve as the custodian to GLD and SLV, the two largest precious metal ETFs, GLD for gold, SLV for silver. So you have a situation where the custodian for the largest ETFs, whose shareholders would like their prices to go up, have a vested interest in seeing the price go down. And that is not disclosed in the GLD and SLV prospectus. I believe that's a material omission, and I believe the sort of there are games going on in the commodities markets and there are games going on in the securities markets, and there's no regulator who's looking at it on an integrated basis and saying, well, wait a minute, does this make any sense? And you don't need a regulator to do that, because if you look at the disclosure laws related to securities, that's something that private investors can enforce with class action and other civil suits. So check that out on the blog, because the whole topic of manipulation in the commodities markets is about to go to a whole new level. And that's going to come up in our discussion with Jim Norman again tonight, because it's similar issues going on in the oil markets and the energy markets, and the tension between using our markets, whether commodities or financial markets, as an instrument of national security, as opposed to something, a market that's supposed to allocate information and capital to the real economy. Very, very big uh-oh in the state and local area. More and more people beginning to realize the severity of the financial issues. We saw the King report this week come out and start to really use the default word with respect to municipal bonds, pointing out last year investors poured $7.8 billion into the high-yield municipal bond market. It's a little scary. Even more scary was the dirty politics. We saw articles in The Economist called Sharing the Pain. Increasing budget deficits and rising government debts are likely to entail fierce political battles, not least between taxpayers and public sector workers. Then in Barron's, the $2 trillion hole promised pension benefits for public sector employees represent a massive overhang that threatens the financial future of many cities and states. I hate to be simplistic about it, but be careful of these articles. They're all a pile of bunk. Basically, what they're doing is saying, now that we've siphoned off enormous resources through the back door, and after we've put a ton of crap into the pension funds and hurt their value, rather than really deal with all the money that's disappeared and where it's gone, what we're going to do is we're going to try and pit state and local taxpayers against the civil service and their retirement benefits. It's a little bit like the perps trying to turn the victims against each other. Not to say that there aren't occasional outrages, in terms of behavior by either taxpayers or deals made by some civil service workers or particularly with respect to retirement benefits. But the framing is fundamentally flawed and fundamentally false and will not get us to any real solutions. I mean, before you operate, you need a proper diagnosis. So beware. It wouldn't surprise me as we go into the state and local budget balancing that we start to see the efforts to turn people against each other and play he said, she said, up to a much higher volume. Half Past Human has a new issue of Shape of Things to Come. Very interesting. One of the things they point out is the tension over people beginning to realize the church reserves that have been socked away, and it was a little reminder to me, always focusing on the money that's leaving the back door out of government. And Cliff High of Half Past Human makes a good point, because there's a lot of amazing stories in the church endowments and reserves. There's lots of focus on the challenges posted or the challenges coming to our food supply by weather and weather changes. And it just reminds me, I'm going to keep coming back to the importance again and again in the Soleri report and on the blog about creating your local food supply. In that vein, let me just announce that I'm going to be on vacation next week, and Ana E. Starr, who runs our operations and has a long history running a food business up in Kalispell, Montana, and all sorts of incredible knowledge and network in the food area, is going to be blogging with a focus on food and gardening on the blog while I'm out. So we're just going to keep coming back to that because it's so, so important. Our hero this week is Ron Paul. Just when you think that no one can possibly make a difference in Washington, Paul's refusal to budge on the core monetary issues on their importance, the importance of the Constitution and adhering to the Constitution, came out again in recent questioning of Bernanke. His insistence on doing so just returns a sense of sanity, makes you feel like the militia is indeed holding the line. And I just hope they protect him somehow from whatever is befalling Kucinich. Again, in this situation, a Democrat like Kucinich is going to be far more strategically important than any Republican, including Paul. But, it's just a reminder of what gems the good guys are who stay in the machinery and keep plugging. Ask Catherine. We got a great question this week from a subscriber who wrote in and said, I've listened a couple times to your March 4th documentary on the 2010 census, but I still have a question about what we should do. It comes down to the difference between reply and comply, or on and on. What's your recommendation? So I wrote back and said, here's our report on the consensus on the blog. In fact, I've moved it up again. You know, my whole focus with doing these special reports is really to help you with any kind of action you're going to be called to do, like the swine flu or like the census. So I like to get these things written up and up on the blog early. So now that the census is coming out, I'm moving it up to the top. Here's how I feel about trusting the federal government with data. And then I sent him a link to my article, The Data Beast, which you can find at the archive in which I initially wrote in response to healthcare. And then it says, here's a comment on some of the contractors involved. And I post a link to the contractors who have been named as the lead on the census data. Again, it will be private corporate contractors who will receive and manage and archive that data. So if you trust them with your data, you might want to read my Data Beast article and make a decision about whether you feel comfortable. Given their history, one of the contractors, IBM, was the contractor who helped the Nazis build the databases they used for the Holocaust. So I leave it to you to decide. Then I wrote, here's what I'm doing. I'm not responding to the census. So I'm not. The census will be shredded here in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, at my house. And then I wrote, because each person's personal situation is unique and because legal issues may be involved, it is not my policy to make a blanket recommendation. Historically, I've found that blanket recommendations end up setting the exceptions to the rule in the wrong direction. So I now try to provide as much information as possible as I can figure as possible so you can figure out what is appropriate in your situation. I did want to mention it was reported to me by one of our Solari team members that Fox News had covered the census and was saying there was a $100 fine for failure to reply to each question. That's not the case. If you read our report, it's a $100 fine if you fail on the whole report, not $100 per question. I had my attorney check that. The Solari team person also checked that. And so, you know, a negative gold star to Fox News for doing that. Anyway, so I'm not complying. As far as I'm concerned, the more data you give the federal government, the more dangerous the federal government will be. Okay, that's it for Ask Catherine. And next, Jim Norman and the oil card. Now, let me give you some background on Jim before I bring him in. He's a wonderful reporter. He's done extraordinary work. He writes for McGraw-Hill's Platts Oilgram News. He's been the senior editor at Forbes magazine and at Business Week. He served as the Houston bureau chief. He started off with the local beat. In fact, he won an AP award for investigative reporting on, are you ready for this, an oil and gas scam. Among other things, he's worked in Auckland, New Zealand. So you all know my love for New Zealand, so I'm just very impressed. I've been asked to prepare a list of my top books. If I was going to make a haven't finished it yet, but the top 10 books to understand the current economy, his book, The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century, would absolutely be on that list. And I just have to tell you all a story. When I first got the oil card, I was very excited because I've been looking for years for a book that could really help me understand the energy markets, you know, that was compatible with my understanding of the world. And so when I found out that Jim had written a book, I immediately got it. And I was traveling, and I went down to eat dinner, and I thought, okay, well, I'll take the oil card, and I'll read it. And I started reading, and I couldn't put it down. I ended up closing down the restaurant. I was the last person to leave. I had to leave because they were closing. And then I got back to my room and was up half the night because I literally couldn't put it down. So I think I went to bed at 3 o'clock. So in preparation for the Solera report, I thought, okay, well, I've read it, so now it's safe. I can read it in a couple sittings. I picked it up. Same thing happened. I couldn't put it down. Ended up being up till 3 a.m. the next morning. Went to sleep and hadn't finished it because I'm normally a speed reader, but I have to read it slowly because it's so juicy. And so I got up the next morning and I didn't even bother to get dressed. I just finished the oil card. So this is to underscore this is a wonderful book to read. It's very well written. It condenses so much deep knowledge of the world and of geopolitics and of oil and energy. It's really extraordinary and reflects, you know, just literally decades and decades of writing and covering this stuff. And so this is a book that you absolutely, you know, if you want to understand the economy, this is a book you want to get. And if you just want to enjoy a great read, it's a book you should get. So with that, let me introduce Jim Norman. Are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for those very kind words.
Well, they were very well deserved. Well, let's just dive right in, Jim, because we have so much to cover, and it's great stuff. You start off in the oil card describing the 80s and the strategy that the United States used literally to really bring down the Soviet Union. So why don't you just dive in and describe your hypothesis?
Right. Well, when oil prices started to run up in the late 90s, I started to think, you know, there's something very odd about this. Could you possibly manipulate the global market of a highly fungible commodity like crude oil? Seems completely counterintuitive. But I came across a very interesting book by a fellow named Peter Schweitzer, who went back and wrote, the title of it was called Victory, and it was a bunch of interviews with the people from the Reagan National Security Council about how they really broke the Soviets. And what was contained in that book was the just almost offhanded disclosure that, oh, yeah, we manipulated the price of oil downward. That was a key element of breaking the Soviets in the 80s. Didn't go into a lot of explanation about how they did it, but I went back because I had been working for Business Week in Houston during the 80s, and I knew at that time that Exxon was behaving very bizarrely in those years. The price of oil was falling, and yet they were ramping up their capital spending to unheard-of levels, drilling wells like it was the end of the world, and they were vastly ramping up their oil production, exactly what you would not do in that kind of a market. Somebody back then told me, oh, well, it's because we're going after the Russians. Didn't make sense to me at the time, but when you go back and look at it, you see when the United States government has an important enough national security agenda, it has a whole raft of resources it can bring to bear on markets to effect economic warfare. And that's exactly what we did in the 1980s, and we did it so well. I mean, it led to the bloodless collapse of our arch rival at the time, the Soviet Union. It took more than a decade, but it worked. And so I basically went back, reconstructed exactly how did we do it? How did we manipulate that market? The basic.
I remember when I first started to get to know the group, the now at GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and they were arguing that the precious metals market was being manipulated, and what they were running into was a wide group of people who couldn't fathom that a global market could be that manipulated.
Right.
And it can. I mean, it absolutely can, and the tools that the United States government has to do it, you know, grow stronger every day.
Yeah, it turns out it's not that hard to do if you are the U.S. government. And
it
really boils down to a handful of key ingredients here when we're talking about oil. Number one, the Saudis. We have them by the short hairs. They march in lockstep with our national security agenda. Whatever other surface political differences we have with them, they are a key element here. It's a close symbiotic relationship. When we want more oil on the market, they do it. When we want less oil on the market, they do it. Same thing with the international major companies, particularly the U.S. majors. And Exxon is the paradigm for the group, I think. It's interesting to watch the pattern of their capital spending, how much they spend, where they spend it, what the level of their liquids production is at any given time. That kind of tells you which way the wind is blowing as well. Then when you either loosen or tighten up the physical market for oil, then you really bring high-powered effects to bear through the futures market, which is just throwing money at it. You can bid the price up. You can bid the price down. And that's where you really drive prices.
And you can make money on the price. The oil companies can make a lot of money on prices falling if they know it's going to fall.
Well, if not the oil companies themselves, certainly people who are in the know can run this as a profit center. And it becomes a self-funding kind of enterprise. The trick, though, the key trick is to bring in other people to do the heavy lifting. And what we've seen in the oil markets and all of the commodity markets in the last few years is that by some astute tinkering with the commodity futures rules, the government has been able to lure in, actually channel in vast amounts of pension and other seemingly conservative investment money to just flood these rather small niche commodity futures markets and drive the prices completely out of whack. Oil and many other commodities now really do not trade at all in any relationship to the actual physical supply and demand for the commodities.
I think at one point in the oil court, you talk about Exxon's finding cost right now.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, the cost of Exxon's finding cost, it's actually the cost of merely finding a barrel of oil on the ground is only about 50 cents. It might have gone up to 70 cents in the last year or so. The cost of actually finding and developing it, that is drilling the wells, putting all the steel in place, it's still only about $5 to $10 a barrel. So for oil to be trading at $80 a barrel now, it's totally crazy, especially at a time when the world is actually swimming in oil. We've got oil coming out of our ears. It's stockpiled
all over
the place.
And the more the economy slows down, the more oil we're going to have.
Right, and that's why there's such a disconnect. Even though oil is down from its peak, you know, it hit a brief peak in mid-2008 of almost $150 a barrel.
Which is astonishing.
Yeah, it fell to the 40s. And then it has since come back. For the last year, it has traded in a very narrow range of $70 to $80 a barrel, which in itself kind of tells you somebody has decided this is the price of oil and that's what it's going to be, regardless of supply and demand factors. So
now, when the Soviet Union broke apart and the U.S., I mean, we are business community, and the Treasury went in a very big way to help with privatization. Didn't we pick up, and European investors pick up, a lot of interest in their oil industry?
Well, when the Soviet Union fell apart, it became kind of it was just a free-for-all there. There were assets to be had all over the place. What you saw emerge was a class of oligarchs funded from, you don't really know where, who snatched up all kinds of assets from the failing empire, privatized them. Some of them have been renationalized. Some are sort of functioning like private companies. But, you know, whether this was just a way for the KGB to retain ownership or whether this is foreign money getting involved, it's all very murky and shifting.
Right.
The point is, though, that Russia remains heavily dependent on crude oil exports for all of its hard currency earnings, as well as a few other raw materials, gold they sell, iron ore, basic commodities. They don't make anything that's worth exporting for money, so they rely
right.
on natural resource sales. When we drove down the price of oil in the 80s, we took away the key source of their earnings, and it took a decade, but by the end of the 80s, they were broke. What really broke the Soviet Union was when Mikhail Gorbachev ran out of money, had to go hat in hand to the West. The banks wouldn't even lend to him. He had to go to governments to borrow money, $100 billion or so, in order to buy wheat to feed the Russian people. And it was the strings attached to those loans which prevented him from moving his armies into Eastern Europe when Lithuania and Poland and East Germany and everybody else rose up and said, we're done with you guys. That's
right.
when the Soviet Union fell apart. And it was an astounding economic warfare victory.
Yeah.
So I asked the question, well, if we could do it so well against the Russians, could we do it against our current opponent, which is the People's Republic of China?
I mean, the answer is, of course.
Yeah. What you can see is that we basically used all the same levers that we used to push the price down and hold it down for a decade. We're using all those levers in reverse now, or we're using them aggressively up until the middle of 2008 to push that price up. And
so describe China. I mean, it's very interesting in the book. You walk through China's strategic position with respect to oil and energy versus the United States. And it paints a very different picture than I think most people assume.
Yeah. I think most of the conventional wisdom out there is really misguided. China has oil, but they only have about half of what they need right now. And it's very hard for them to get it out of the ground. It's cruddy stuff, low-grade oil. Their refining system is not equipped to deal with it very well. What they have to do is import lots and lots of sweet crude, particularly from the Middle East. They import, percentage-wise, they import as much or more of what we do. The trouble with that is that they're buying it with a currency that's probably 30 or 40% undervalued.
Right, because they're pegging it to ours. They're trying to export.
Right. Yeah, that's part of their...
And that helps with in terms of building manufacturing base, in terms of exports, but it's killing them on the oil.
Right. You see, this is the thing. Their whole strategy is to keep their people employed by exporting. 40% of their GDP, roughly, is from exports.
Right.
And so they're keeping their people employed, but where they're naked and exposed is on key raw material inputs, particularly crude oil and iron ore. And you're particularly seeing it in iron ore now, but you're also seeing it in bauxite. Pretty soon you're going to see it in copper. All of these strategic metals and industrial processes that the Chinese have determined to build up in order to strengthen themselves from a geopolitical standpoint, they're exposed on the raw materials side. And so
right, and
it's
one of the things I found fascinating was it's not just how much they need, it's the long lines that they have to and the expensive lines they have to employ to ship it in.
That's right. I mean,
so
this sets up a dynamic where at high oil prices, the United States gets a cold, the Chinese get pneumonia. And the reason is because we
right.
import crude from our friends, the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Saudis. It
right.
comes by pipeline in many cases, which is the cheapest way you can move it, or very large tankers through friendly waters in our own boats from our friends. So the money stays in the family. Basically, we'd be subsidizing the Saudis, the Canadians, the Mexicans if oil prices were half what they are now. So the money is staying.
Well, the other thing
in.
Is if you look at our Navy, we control the sea lanes.
Right. The Chinese, on the other hand, they buy their oil from strangers. They ship
right.
it in other people's boats halfway around the world through waters controlled by the U.S. Navy, and they buy it with an undervalued currency. We could play this game all day and all night. And the Chinese are screaming mad about it. I mean,
Well, it's interesting. If you know, somebody will say, oh, the Chinese treasury reserves are so huge. Well, if the sea lanes cut off the oil, how long will that treasury reserve, how long will that cash reserve
well,
finance
you know,
the wheat?
This Chinese dollar hoard is another major misperception by people. People think as if they own us now. No, it's
right.
The other way around. They've got us right where we want them.
Right.
They can't spend that money. The reason they built up this huge pile of dollars is because on all the exports, they get to get dollars in return. They have to buy up those dollars to avoid inflation in their own economy. And so
although I think they can turn around and make long-term swap deals around the world for critical reserves.
Well,
they can buy for dollars.
Yeah, they've been trying to
be holding in their inventory, but it's basically been swapped out in a contract for real stuff.
Well, what they've tried to do is buy equity ownership of reserves in the ground all over the globe, and they've had some limited success. Mostly what you find, if you critically look at the Chinese resource deals, is they pay top dollar for doggy assets in problematic countries where they still can't be assured of getting the stuff out of the ground and back home. So
right.
Who wins on these deals?
Right. Well, we've seen them when they tried to take a bigger than 4.9% position here, how the political screaming went off the charts.
Yeah, the Unical case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was. I actually have a somewhat conspiratorial take on it. I think the Chinese knew they were never going to get the first base on that, but it was a way for them to kind of force the U.S. to expose its hand there on what it's really doing, which is isolating
China. Well, that makes sense. I'm sure they knew they were going to get the scream.
Yeah, but what the Chinese viewpoint on this is that they view themselves as surrounded by U.S. allies and the targets of an economic war. I think they're right. Of course, it would be absolutely denied by anyone in Washington or anywhere else around the globe. But if you look at the evidence in terms of the actual market activities here, you can see why the Chinese could have some reason to be paranoid here.
Well, although it's interesting, we bust the Soviet Union, and there's a period of honeymoon between us and China because we pull an incredible amount of money out of the U.S. economy and reinvest in Asia, including China, with China being a huge inflow of American or American engineered capital in the first part of the Clinton administration. So there was a period of honeymoon before things started to turn.
Oh yeah. In fact, the Chinese really were the point man for us getting the Russians out of Afghanistan. The Chinese and us really combined forces to break the Soviet Union. And so China was rewarded in the 1980s by warming U.S. relations. It was Bush 1 who got them most favored nation status, which was renewed by Clinton, who then got him into the World Trade Organization. When Tiananmen Square occurred in 1989, Bush 1 put him in timeout for a couple of months, and then it was back to business as usual. I think,
which was an given what had happened at Tiananmen Square, it was an extraordinary political feat by Bush.
Right, right. I think what the original strategy was: let's all get along. We'll be nice to these guys. They'll be capitalists like us. We'll all get rich, and nobody will bother each other. But I think it was by the late in the second Clinton term, it became painfully obvious that China was on an aggressive move to militarize itself, to gain the capacity to confront us at some point in the future. They were lying, cheating, and stealing on their trade deals, and
right.
They were stealing us blind on secrets and military technology and everything else. We were under full court press from them in, I guess, what you'd call asymmetric warfare. And I think it was actually during the end of Clinton's reign when the China economic war strategy really kicked in. You saw the beginning of the upward oil price movements at that time, and we did get them into the WTO, but I think the idea was we would be able to restrain Chinese rapacious mercantilistic behavior that way. In fact, it's been a rather dismal failure.
Well, it's interesting in the Asian fiscal crisis, what happened was we clearly pulled the credit. So we pulled the credit, things slammed down, we have a quote-unquote crisis, and you see American and English hedge fund and European investors going in and taking equity positions in companies that normally no foreigners would ever be allowed to take equity positions. And
this is the late 90s you're talking about.
Yeah, this is 97, 98, picking things up at 10 cents on the dollar.
Right. Same thing with the Russian currency.
I mean, it was incredible. It was like a shopping, you know, those old TV shows where you get a shopping cart and you have 5 minutes to get as much
yeah.
as you want?
Right.
Well, that's, I mean, the hedge fund managers were all running around Asia acting like pigs with their shopping cart. So,
yeah.
You know, and I think what that was an encircling of China. Okay, let's get strategic positions all around. And make sure, you know, we've got positions all around their border, and if we can't enjoy a good relationship with them, we can get the benefit from equity positions and all these others.
Yeah, and you know, there was a large flow of U.S. direct foreign investment into China, which would have been helping him out, of course. But if you look at the flow of that money, most of it went into the coastal cities, into high-tech businesses, the export-oriented businesses. So these were the only businesses in China, really, that have made any money to speak of. So
right.
Foreigners are basically taking the cream off the top of the pot here. China, most Chinese industry, loses money. People don't realize that, particularly if you discounted back the heavy subsidies for electricity, metallurgical coal, all kinds of other cheap financing and everything else. Chinese aren't making any money.
Well, except for this, the Chinese are unbelievably, you know, one of my theories, because I studied Chinese in Hong Kong and then got my first degree in history, but it was Chinese history, is the Roman Empire and the British Empire, you know, basically went broke trading with the Chinese, and the Brits turned it around with opium. But what the Chinese do, and you saw them do it all throughout the 90s, was they will learn a business by losing money, but they'll do it very strategically, but they'll learn it. And so they'll bring in foreign companies, they'll bring in a foreign partner, they'll get them to teach that, they'll acquire the intellectual capital. Once they've acquired the intellectual capital, they'll try and create some kind of monopoly situation, and then they'll jack up their prices and they'll start making money. But
yeah.
But they
yeah.
have they have ways of, you know, going 10 to 20 years to build their base and get their intellectual mastery of something.
Right. Well, that's why the pattern of their investment is so worrisome to all the West, not just the United States, but Europe as well. The Chinese have half the world's steelmaking capacity now. They account
right.
for a third of all world steel exports. They've moved to take over the aluminum industry in the same way. They're moving on copper. They own the cement business. They own the flat glass business. Once you reach significant economies of scale, nobody else can compete with you. You just
see,
take
that's
their
what
market.
They do. They buy their way into intellectual mastery and economies of scale, and then, you know, it's a very long, flat, you know, in the beginning S curve. But then once they go up the S curve, they're awesome.
Yeah, but they have made themselves exceptionally vulnerable. And it's
right.
it's they're cruising for a collapse worse than what the United States had in the 1930s. You know, the United States had a very similar position in the 1930s. We had accumulated vast amounts of foreign reserves because we had become the world supplier of all these basic materials and so forth. We were getting fat off that, and we were, you know, other people were losing market share to us. It was the foreign governments which rose up with protective retaliation that sparked the Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Right.
Trade collapsed, and the United States suffered more than anybody else because we were overcapacitized, just as the Chinese are, and all of these basic industrial processes that couldn't support themselves. And the United States suffered vastly more than Britain or many other countries during the Great Depression for exactly that reason. And China is cruising towards a similar kind of cliff, I think.
Right. And there's no doubt you see all sorts of unbelievable bubbles. And the real estate bubble in some of the markets in China, it takes your breath away.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you know, when you hold interest rates at zero, Jim, you're gonna have stupid money bubbling up. Ultimately, everything.
Yeah. Well, the object is to keep the dollar weak, to basically put all the more pressure on China and to squeeze their ability to export into our market. For them to do that, they have to keep their currency weak and pegged to the dollar. That means they're buying their raw materials abroad at painfully uneconomic prices. And it's interesting to see, you know, what's going on, like, between the Chinese and the Australians now on iron ore pricing.
Is this the Rio Tinto?
Yeah, I mean, they threw four Rio guys into prison and charged them with spying. Is a way of trying to bring down the price of iron ore here. But China is extremely vulnerable to a handful of Western companies, really, on their iron ore prices.
Right.
You see a pattern developing here that when the Chinese move from being an importer to an exporter of these kind of metals, all of a sudden you see the raw material price goes through the roof and the finished metal price goes through the floor. You've seen that on aluminum. You're going to see it on copper.
The world is really upside down, isn't it?
It is. And this tells you that it ain't just natural economics that are driving this stuff. There's, you know, we see where they're vulnerable and we beat up on them. And they do the same thing to us, too. So it's economic warfare, the way of the future.
Now, how does Russia fit in with this now? I mean, Russia is enjoying the run-up in prices again.
Yeah, well, they need to. And I think we are actually – that's why we're, I think, holding oil in this trading range of $70 to $80 a barrel, because below that, the Ruskies are hurting big time. So I think we need to – at least have them in walking around money. And I think that it has paid off, because I think it has actually prevented the Soviets, the Russians, from teaming up again with the Chinese out of necessity. You know, there was...
Even though they're bitter enemies.
They hate each other. They don't trust each other. The Russians are scared to death of the Chinese, because the Chinese they're massively armed and populated, could easily take all of eastern Siberia. The Russians couldn't defend it except with nuclear weapons. And so the Russians have relented and are starting to supply small amounts of crude oil at high prices to China through a new pipeline they've built at great expense, mainly which runs out to the Pacific so they can ship the oil to Japan, China's main enemy. So the Russians have been helping us supply our troops in Afghanistan, which I think you have to view as kind of a blocking position between China and Iran. Clearly, we're not there because of the Taliban. There's something else going on, and it's a geopolitical positioning. Well, that's one of the other outrageous things I put in the book. You know, the real reason why we invaded Iraq was to keep the Chinese out of there. You know, where Saddam had crossed the line was he had actually signed deals to give the Chinese rights to several massive undeveloped oil fields there. And as soon as U.N. sanction would have been lifted at the end of 2003, you'd have had Chinese boots on the ground in Iraq garrisoning large oil fields. We'd never get them out of there. And so,
and that's oil they could truck or pipeline to China direct across the land, right?
Well, with Iran, I don't know if a pipeline to China is really that economic, but if you had Iran as a Chinese client state, then here's the problem. There's a thing called the Carter Doctrine. This goes back to Jimmy Carter's days, even before 1980, and what it said was if any foreign power moves to gain control of Middle Eastern oil reserves, the United States will respond as if it were a direct threat to our national interest and would use military force if necessary to prevent it. That's all of the authorization we needed to invade Iraq with the Chinese component. And, you know, Saddam was inviting disaster when he let those contracts. And Iran is doing the same thing. You know, Iran has given the Chinese rights to come in and redevelop at least two very major oil fields there. The Chinese are offering to rebuild half of Iran's dilapidated refining capacity. There's a huge arms trade, Chinese arms going into Iran. And if there were a flare-up, which caused shooting to break out there, you would probably see the Straits of Hormuz close. I don't think it would necessarily be the Iranians who would close it. If you look, who would benefit from a closing of the Straits of Hormuz? We would. We'd still get oil. We could still pay for it. China's main supply would be cut off, and Iran would be screwed. They would have no way of getting their oil out of there. So,
well, I keep coming back to the ceilings because, to me, the if you look at what I call the central banking warfare model, that model has been at the heart of the Anglo-American alliance for centuries, and it comes down to the warfare part of it comes down to the control of the ceilings. So, if you're China and you've got that many people and you're that dependent on oil and you don't control the sea lanes, I would think it would be unbelievably frustrating.
Right. And, the efforts China has made to try and secure excess have been less than successful. They've been trying to beef up their navy. It's a very slow process. They're trying to build a pipeline through Myanmar, oil and gas, that would allow them to circumvent the Straits of Malacca. That's a very expensive process, and it would only get them halfway to the Persian Gulf. They've, Pakistan is an interesting player here. They have been, actually, a long time, in effect, viewed by the West as a Chinese client state. And so when you see us beating up on Pakistan and Afghanistan, I think you have to keep in mind the likelihood that what we are doing is severing Pakistan as a usable Chinese client state. The Chinese have tried to build military or port facilities in Pakistan. And so I think that whatever Pakistan does that tilts towards China invites a reaction from the U.S. and the West.
Do you think we'll go to war in Iran?
No, I think it's all just saber-rattling. I think that the cooler heads will prevail. But who knows? Who knows? It seems like a situation that is on an inexorable slide. Here's the way I've been told from a diplomatic friend of mine who knows the Chinese well. He says, look, the Chinese, ever since the late 90s, knew they were going to sooner or later come eyeball to eyeball with the United States. They figured they had 20 years to prepare for that, to get strong enough for it so that when that moment came, they wouldn't have to shoot. The U.S. would just know it was a no-win situation and just back down. What I think has happened is the United States has seen that same dynamic at work and has decided, well, we're going to control the clock on this. We're not going to give you 20 years. We're going to speed things up a bit. We're going to put you in a full-court press. And so when Bush invaded Iraq, China had to sit back and just say, well, okay. So they got some sand kicked in their face there. Now, what happens if we go after Iran? Is China going to stand up and say no? I don't think so. I mean, they've tried to hold it up in the UN Security Council. But, I mean, world opinion, I think, is heavily against Iran, and China is going to have to be forced to back down on that as well, I think. So China has a relatively weak hand, and I think that it's not that we're being driven by events necessarily. I think you have to look at it as an aggressive agenda here where we're getting in their face pretty good.
Right. Well, certainly, with troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and if you look at what we're doing on the ground, we're planning on a very long occupation.
Right. You look at the relationship with India as well. We've really tilted very heavily toward India. And India and China are natural-born enemies to begin with. And if you look at the odd things going along their disputed multi-thousand-mile border, both sides seem to be gearing up for eventual military conflict along that whole front, it seems like. China's been building roads, railroads.
What would cause that military conflict?
It could be anything, some border dispute or whatever. I mean, they're like dogs and cats. They're destined to fight each other, I think.
Well, their cultures are phenomenally different. I mean, it's like two different planets.
But I would think the West, particularly the United States, wouldn't mind that. I mean, we certainly wouldn't let China beat up on India very well. And so you see us selling military hardware to India or encouraging, you know, some of it's going to come from Russia. But I think we've helped out the Indians immensely in a number of ways here, and they are rapidly strengthening themselves. As chaotic a society as they have, I think that they might not be a match for the Chinese right now, but they're coming on strong.
Good. The Chinese, the population now is about 1.3 billion?
That's the official number. It's probably 1.5 billion if you counted all of the undocumented female children that just don't get reported.
Disappeared. What? How big is the Indian population at this point?
Gosh, I don't know. It's probably 1 billion or so, something like that.
I don't know if you saw the Economist article on gendercide. There was one, and it was talking about the sort of the disappearing female children.
Mm-hmm.
And literally what the Chinese population would look like in 20 years in terms of men outnumbering women. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you were looking for a population policy designed to breed an army of ferocious warfighters.
Right, there it is.
You know? But look what China has done to itself. It's made themselves the fastest aging society on the planet. This is not a healthy recipe for the future.
Right.
You know, I think that most of these efforts for zero population growth backfire. They're really not sound economics, as Europe is finding out.
Now, I just have to bring up peak oil.
Oh, my favorite subject.
Because I'm one of those people who's, you know, it was very recently I had somebody inform me that they were never going to speak to me again because I didn't believe in peak oil.
Well, yeah, as I point out in the book, you know, the whole 1980s price run down on crude was accompanied by an elaborate propaganda effort at the time saying, oh, the world's got plenty of reserves. Look, everybody's... they're finding new oil all the time. In fact, Matt Simmons, who is like the lead guru of the peak oil crowd, back then when he was running an investment bank in Houston and merging companies together out of desperation, he was telling everybody, you better merge because oil's never going to recover. There's going to be oil surplus as far as the eye can see. Well, then in the 90s, he had an epiphany, and he realized, oh, why, those Saudis were lying about those reserves. I'm shocked, shocked. We better start gearing up for high oil prices. You know, the world's going to run out of oil. If you talk to any geologist, they will tell you the Earth's crust has got hydrocarbons all over the place. It just hasn't been drilled for enough yet. And besides
that... Well, then what the peak folks who believe in peak oil say is, yeah, but if you look at the cost of drilling it, it's, you know, it's... much more expensive, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's because the oil companies like huge offshore oil developments now. Why? Because, yeah, the cost is high, but you find a whole lot of oil. And guess what? You can buy the lease from one seller, the U.S. government.
Right.
And you don't have to drive across somebody's property to get there. You can produce oil and gas all you want offshore, lots of it, and then move the platform somewhere else. I mean, they're just doing what comes naturally. Yeah, if you just wanted to drill individual wells onshore, that might not be a winner. On the other hand, there's huge amounts of oil found still sitting in the ground that's amenable to enhanced oil recovery. We're just beginning that. I think that's part of the reason that they're trying to go to war on CO2, because ultimately the game plan would be to turn that into a commodity that you could put in a pipeline and put it back in the ground for enhanced oil recovery. So,
one of the subscribers sent in a note that I forwarded to you about the Forbes, who was it?
I'm sorry, I didn't see that
About
yet.
6 months ago, the writer was watching a news program on oil, and one of the Forbes brothers was the guest. The host said to Forbes, I'm going to ask you a direct question. I would like a direct answer. How much oil does the U.S. have in the ground? Forbes speed more than all the Middle East put together. And then they talk about the deposits up in North Dakota and northern Montana.
Yeah. Well, there is large, vast amounts of oil up there, but it's in what's called tight formations. So the wells are expensive. They flow rather slowly. And the all-in cost is, let's say, $10 a barrel. Well, the marginal cost for the Saudis is still only $5 a barrel. So you're vulnerable that somebody could come along and trash the price on you at some point or other. That's why the Saudis and the Russians still really call the shots on oil. But what I note in the book is that in 2003, the Saudis and the Russians actually signed a market management agreement after which Russia's fast increasing exports abruptly stopped, and ever since then they've been maintained at exactly half the level of Saudi exports. Coincidence? I ask you. And as a result, we've avoided flooding the market with crude oil. This is part of the game plan. If you want to run the price up, you don't have to deprive anybody of oil, but you have to snug up the market. And so what you had was, in vast contrast to the 1980s, the major oil companies in the late 90s and the past decade were greatly restricting their upstream capital spending so that they weren't growing their production at all. They were sitting on their hands. The Saudis as well. And then when you bring the Russians in, you could see where you could tighten up the market so it's just snug. Then you throw money at the futures market. Money at the futures market. And that's where this Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which had the so-called Enron loophole, that
had
a whole bunch of things.
Can you just explain for a second what that was?
Well, the Enron loophole, basically it allowed unlimited electronic trading of energy futures outside the regulation of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. No position limits, no nothing. Didn't have to disclose who it was. And Enron was allowed to do that. In fact, that's basically how Enron funded itself. If you know, in your early remarks tonight, you were talking about how the big Wall Street banks are demanding big deposits from their counterparties but not putting them up themselves. That's how Enron worked. Enron was the bank. They didn't have to put up collateral on all of these deals flowing in through Enron Online. And Enron reported all that stuff as it was operating cash flow. Nobody could tell whether they were really generating any cash or not, because it was all these deposits from their online trading stuff.
Wow.
And not only that, the CFTC let that business migrate to London, where it's not subject to the same position limit rules and you can do all kinds of funny stuff in London. And the CFTC basically sat by and let the Intercontinental Exchange set up crude trading in London. Then they could say, oh, well, we've got to deregulate it in the United States or else the business will flow to London. A rather circuitous.
We're hearing that a lot these days.
Yeah. So now the CFTC is in the process of drafting some rules that supposedly are going to tighten up the market. In fact, they will just perpetuate the same mess we have, because what it allows is this basically unrestricted flow of pension and other managed money into the oil market, virtually all of which comes in on the long side, the buy side, buying contracts out there on the curve. And it actually restricts the speculators. Now, the speculator is a technical term for people who are not commercials. And what's happened is that all the swap dealers, the big banks, along with the oil majors, have been declared as commercial players. They're not subject to position limits. They can have unlimited amounts of contracts out there.
Right, so it's the same two-class problem.
Yeah. So the problem is not too many speculators. There aren't enough speculators. If
right.
there were more speculators to come in to take the sell side or the short side.
Well, you can't. You can't afford to play against the house.
That's right. That's the thing. And so, and they restricted the number of players. And you can see which you're not going to stand in front of a freight train here. You can see which way this market was running. In 2007, the price, ran up from $100 a barrel to $150. All the shorts got slaughtered.
Right.
So you know, it was just once you set that ball in motion, it's just, you just can't stop it.
The hardest thing as an investor in this kind of market is if you're not an insider, how can you, you know, where's the investment strategy that works when you're not an insider? Because so much is being driven by the sort of the insider's advantages and
right.
the inside information on where things are going to go. And in the short run, as you know, things can be very Orwellian.
Right. Now, that's why I've tried to just stand back and say, you know, what's the macro picture going here? Oh, these free markets, supposedly free markets, clearly aren't working. What's really driving it? When you realize that, okay, we're in a high oil price milieu at this point. It looks like that's the way it's going to be. It could take 20 years for these policies to have their effect. So, okay, high oil prices. Natural gas, however, is as cheap as it's ever been in relation to oil. I mean,
right. They're
like giving this stuff away. That's the main U.S. fuel, industrial
right. And
electrical and home heating fuel. So we're getting a bargain on that. But transportation fuels based on petroleum, they're going to be high, affordable to the U.S. Again, we get a cold, the Chinese get pneumonia on this, and their demands for imported oil are going to go up and up and up.
Right, and if you look at what we're paying, it's a lot less than the Europeans.
That's true. That's also true because of their tax levels. Here's my point. I think the challenge for the economic managers here is going to be how to keep the price up because demand is falling so much. And supply, the trick is to keep supply off the market. This is where the peak oil people have it all wrong. The main problem the oil industry has always had since we drilled the first well was not how to get oil out of the ground.
How to make it scarce.
The problem is how to keep it in the ground, or at least enough so you don't trash the price. So you look around and, oh, my gosh, you know, guerrilla activity in Nigeria.
I had all sorts of people, you know, emailing me and saying, Morgan Stanley is renting more storage capacity and, you know, holding more off the market, and there's all sorts of games going on.
Well, that's partly how Morgan Stanley qualifies as a commercial player. They rent storage all over the place. So
yeah. As
long as you have physical product at risk that you're hedging, you get lumped in as a commercial trader. So, you know, your swaps activity gets covered by that, I think.
So here's the question, Jim. If we're going to use, I mean, let's say you're sitting on the National Security Council and you're looking out at the world and saying, you know, there's real competition here between civilizations and we've got to make sure that our civilization is secure, is safe. You know, and so you've got strategic goals and we've reached a world where sort of military strategy and economic strategy have integrated in a way which is very powerful and very sort of it's just very integrated.
It's a continuum, right?
It's a continuum, and it's 24/7,
right?
And you know, across the board in sort of all activities, and so the National Security Council and its strategic purpose takes precedent. The problem is that makes the financial markets and the commodities markets, basically a chessboard of geopolitics, and it can't function as either a way to channel and allocate capital to the real economy and circulate it in the real economy. It can't serve both masters.
Well, they do their best. I think their feeling is, you know, there's capital out there. It's going to go seek a return somewhere or other. But we're not going to let these markets just behave willy-nilly in a free market fashion. That's why you have the plunge protection team. I look at that a bit in the book, too, because my point is that it's pretty well documented that this president's working group on financial markets, headed really and run out of New York Federal Reserve Bank, really has intervened on a number of occasions in the equity markets, the stock market,
and certainly
the bond markets. If you can do that in stocks and bonds, it's a small step from there into the commodities market, which is, I mean, that's chump change compared to stocks and bonds. So why wouldn't you? I mean, why wouldn't you? And in fact, what we looked at in the 80s, when the NYMEX first came into existence, it is an interesting history. This is a failed potato futures exchange. Somehow or other,
right.
Landed the contract to sell crude oil. And it was set up by some rather problematic characters at the time. The biggest trader on the NYMEX in the early days was a fellow named John Deutsch, who was a rather notorious oil trader, widely rumored to have had CIA connections, deeply involved in Russian intrigue of various sorts, maybe a good guy, but he was heavily on the short side, I think, driving down that price. And it was the NYMEX, when the NYMEX came into existence, it was the short selling on the NYMEX, which really pulled down the physical price of crude. It might have fallen slowly anyway, but the NYMEX pulled it down very rapidly and kept it down. So it's these financially settled money markets for commodities, which really drive the price. It ain't just physical supply and demand.
You know, one of my theories, I loved a book on scenario planning called The Art of the Long View, and it was written by one of the guys who had worked in the Shell group, the Shell Strategic Planning Group, before the OPEC roses took the prices way up.
Uh-huh.
And they had asked their managers worldwide to prepare for a scenario where such a thing happened. And they held out that, you know, everyone thought that was impossible, but, you know, lo and behold, it happened. And so the Shell middle management team worldwide was prepared to be effective and really, you know, sort of change course and adapt.
And guess what? They made just as much money with high prices as they did on low prices. In fact, probably more.
Well, it's funny. I got to know the group, and I started to listen to how scenario planning worked, and I realized, oh, my God, here's what happened. The Shell senior guys knew that OPEC was going to happen. It was a plan. And scenario planning was a way to get the middle managers prepared without, you know, you can't tell them that you're going to do this, but you've got to get them prepared. So you give them five different scenarios, and one of them is the one you know is probably going to happen.
The majors actually testified later saying that, you know, it was indifferent to us whether they raised the price. As long as we could pass it through and make money on their refining, that was always the whole game plan anyway. So,
right, but the banks made a fortune on the pools of capital.
No, probably, yeah. And
yeah,
we,
so what
and
you
we made
did
the Saudis
you...
healthy. We made the Saudis healthy. That was an
right.
important ingredient here, which is my point that, you know, if oil prices were low, we'd be bailing them out somewhere or other anyway. So high oil prices, contrary to popular belief, don't hurt the United States. We're relatively indifferent to it. If you consider Canada, Mexico, the U.S., and the Saudis as all part of the same network, we're basically long on crude. So run that price up all day. We don't care.
When I started to look at digital technology and what digital technology was doing, you know, normally you look at something like digital technology and you think, oh, this ought to help decentralize economic and political power. And in fact, when you start to study the nuts and bolts of how the rigging is occurring, digital technology has made an extraordinary contribution to the, you know, the ability to centralize and wage economic war using markets.
Well, yeah, you can move so much more money so much faster now. The
right.
whole pace and tempo. This is an important concept of real war too. You know, the tempo of warfare is a weapon in and of itself. If the other guy can't respond as fast as you, then you step up the pace of things. So even if he's got a bigger army, if he can't move it as fast as yours, you can beat him. And I think this is what we're doing with the Chinese. I think that we're controlling the timetable here, not them. I don't think we are the helpless victims of circumstance here. I think we're the perpetrators. There's a definite effect. I mean, the Chinese are screaming bloody murder now about the jam that they're in here. Their exports are down. They're
right.
getting killed on raw materials. We're leaning on them to raise their currency, and they're saying, oh, no, no, no. If we do that, we're really cooked. So you know, the Chinese.
Well, but if you look at where they're getting hurt and we're getting hurt, what you're watching is the economy slow down in both places, and part of the reason it's slowing down is because of the warfare.
Absolutely.
If you're running an economy to wage war, then the real economy is going to suffer and the trust is going to break down.
Right.
It's happening here and it's probably happening there.
Well, to me, the only way to understand the bizarre behavior of governments around the world right now is to ask the question, are they, in fact, on a war footing? And that's the way they are behaving, actually. Look at the gargantuan amounts of money the United States is spending. We haven't spent this kind of money since World War II.
Right.
And why? It's because I think we are engaged in a life or death conflict.
Right. There's another thing, Jim, and that is if you look at the leadership of business from, you know, it's the entire Anglo-American alliance history. You know, war has been our business. That's what we're good at. That's what's worked. And if you see the establishment that built up after World War I and then World War II, they truly don't believe that we can be successful as a society or as an economy without war.
Right.
And I mean, they're very hooked on war.
Remember what Churchill said about truth during a time of war? She's such a precious commodity. Wherever she travels, she must be accompanied by a bodyguard of lies. So, guess what? They've been lying to us big time.
Well, I think it's very confusing for most people because, I'll often, you see these wonderful people writing on the financial blogosphere, and they really believe the fundamental paradigm is markets. And it's painful to try and communicate with them because they still believe that, you know, they can't fathom that you can manipulate a global oil price in this kind of orchestrated and controlled way. And I mean, actually, if you study the whole history of the oil industry and Rockefeller organized, it's really run as a global federation and very, very tightly orchestrated
organized. The reason is that a fundamental law of economics is that all commodities tend toward glut. And that's why in commodity industries, you inevitably end up with not a monopoly, but an oligarchy of a few strong players supported by government activity, usually, to maintain some semblance of stability in commodity prices so you don't have damaging price swings and shortages and gluts. This was always the preoccupation of early economists. You know, how do you avoid these global glut-type situations? And that's why you've ever since then, if OPEC didn't exist, we'd have had to create it.
Right.
The government here.
I suspect we did.
Right. It's very well. price management of commodities is nothing new. I mean, it's been a preoccupation of policymakers forever. So we should not, delude ourselves thinking that, these completely free markets are out there dictating what we're paying for stuff. Look, free markets are a figment of somebody's imagination. The whole reason we have regulators is to try and make these markets at least appear as if they are behaving according to free markets.
Right, regulators are about risk reduction.
Yeah.
For the businesses.
Right. And speculators are actually in there to ameliorate price swings more than exacerbate them. So this whole free market thing, it's just a delusion that we've been gripped with. Again, because I think there's just a shortage of people who can just say the emperor's not wearing any clothes here.
Well, this is to get back to the oil card, because I think that there's nothing that, you take a group of savvy small business people or farmers, I think there's a great deal that can be done if they can see the game. It's a little bit like if you're on a chessboard and your blindfolded, you know, you're going to get knocked about. But if you can see the chessboard and you can see the players, then you can start, you know, you can start to roll up your sleeves and start to play, or at least duck smartly. So, you know, I just think the oil card is a great, for somebody who's not an oil expert, it's a great introduction to sort of what's going on and a way of thinking about it, which, you know, it fits with what's really going on as opposed to the Orwellian descriptions we get and trying to stuff it into a market paradigm where it just won't fit.
Well, I hate to say it, but, you know, this the oil card has actually, the thesis has held up exceptionally well through all the ups and the downs, too. I mean, it's about as good an explanation as I've seen out there for what's going on here. Now, the part about the Russians and the driving down the price in the 80s, that's hard fact. That's documented. There's a paper trail on that. The argument that I make about running up the price against China, that's more speculative, but I think there's a mountain of circumstantial evidence that supports it, and it fits the pattern. So I offered it up as a way of looking at life to try and explain this stuff, and who knows what the reality is going to prove to be eventually.
Right, but the clash of civilizations is unfolding before us.
That's obvious.
And oil's at the heart of the game.
I think it's a key ingredient. Iron ore is another one. Bauxite. There's a bunch of other stuff, I think, where the Chinese are vulnerable. And you see
have
those
you,
places.
I just have to ask you, because I just wanted to touch on this movie. Have you seen George Clooney's movie, Syriana?
You know, I haven't. I'm not a much of a movie goer. that one would have been a good one, though.
I love it. I mean, because it feels... Some people think it feels weird. I was an investment banker making cold calls. It feels just like it felt, you know. But in it, the Chinese try and do a deal with a Middle Eastern country, and lo and behold, the leader who tries to do the deal ends up with a missile on his head and his brother taking over, who's made a pre-arrangement with the Americans. So
yeah, well,
it's a perfect example of, you know, of the Americans keeping the Chinese away from Middle Eastern oil.
Wherever the Chinese have gone for oil, trouble has followed. You look at Sudan. Oh, my God. I mean, look at Yemen. I mean, Yemen is another case right now. I mean, the Chinese were making inroads there. Various places in West Africa.
Did you ever play Battleships when you were a kid?
Yeah.
It's just like Battleships. They go, we check, they go, we check.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. And Kurt, the Chinese, I think, they have their own. I think they've seen much of this coming at them, and so they've tried to insulate themselves. You know, we can fund ourselves by just printing dollars, basically, because we are the world's reserve currency. The Chinese do it by making bad loans to themselves. They basically keep recapitalizing these state-owned banks, which just make one huge pile of bad loans after another to, again, support these money-losing industries that they've got. Sooner or later, though, the Chinese are going to run out of credit capacity, I think, especially because so much of their industrial investment is fundamentally uneconomic. It's based on just unworkable kind of economic expectations. It's going to collapse at some point.
Right. They're doing in manufacturing what we're doing in real estate.
Yeah, yeah, in a sense, they've vastly overinvested, overbuilt stuff that the world is just not going to have an appetite for.
Jim, how do we keep up with you? Because this book was wonderful. I keep hinting that you should write another book, and I know that's a dreadful thought for you.
Yeah, this one about killed me, and actually I did have some health problems last year, which I'm pretty well over now, and I'm thinking about it. Plath actually has asked me to keep writing for them. I'd like to go back and do some writing for them. There are some other book ideas that I've toyed with. I just got to get pumped up again. Writing a book like this is just, it's a labor of love. Certainly you don't do it to make money.
Right. It's an extraordinary, well, I want everybody to go out and buy the oil card. It's a must have for a library of the 21st century, I think.
The cover art alone, I think, is worth the $15
price. It's a beautiful description. It's up, if you haven't seen it, ladies and gentlemen, it's up on the blog. It's one of my favorite covers too, and it describes perfectly the game. It really does. So, well, Jim, it's been a delight to have you. Thank you so much for joining us on the Solaria Report. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me ramble on here. It's been great fun.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay. Saturday, March 20th is the first day of spring. That's this weekend. And I know after this winter, we're all looking forward to spring. I'm, as I said before, I'm going on vacation next week. Ani Istar runs the Solaria operations, is going to be blogging with a focus on food. Heads up for Solaria Report subscribers, the week of March 29th after I get back, we're going to be sending out an announcement informing you that Solaria is opening a precious metals dealer, Solaria Silver and Gold, and that's going to be in partnership with Franklin Sanders Money Changer. Stay tuned for more about that. We, in our first phase, will be only marketing to Solaria Report subscribers. It's going to be a little bit of an exclusive club. April 1st, first quarter wrap-up. That's the, as you know, at the end of every quarter, I like to just stop and say, okay, you know, where have we come from and where are we going? Our movie is going to be One Man, One Cow, One Planet. I put up the trailer at the blog last week and with a link to the actual video. It's the entire documentary is up online. April 8th is the Precious Market Metals Market Report. We're going to be discussing the top 20 dates in precious metals history, and we'll also be showing you how to use the new calculator at silverandgoldormoney.com. Next week we'll put up our new sort of 2.4 beta version, and it's going to include currencies from around the world and the ability to put in a premium. So a couple of important new features and more on that on April 8th. The movie is going to be The Last Days of Lehman, wonderful one-hour made-for-TV movie the BBC did on the bankruptcy of Lehman. I put it up on the blog this week. You can watch it online. Every time somebody gets it online, it disappears. There's been a real effort to try and make it accessible. It's a very dramatic depiction. You see the players. There's a lot to discuss about that, so I really encourage you to get it, Last Days of Lehman. Until then, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.